Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. Nietzsche published this in 1886 at his own expense, and it sold badly. He had just finished Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which almost nobody understood, and he seems to have decided that the poetry had failed and he would try argument instead. He described this book as saying the same things as Zarathustra, but said differently, and it is much the better place to find out what he actually thought. The subtitle is Prelude to a Philosophy of the Future, and both halves matter. Prelude, because he is clearing ground rather than building. Philosophy of the Future, because he believes the philosophy of the past 2,000 years has been doing something other than what it claimed. The structure is 9 parts and 296 numbered sections, and it is not a continuous argument. Some sections run for pages, others are a single line. Part 4 is nothing but aphorisms. This is deliberate. Nietzsche thinks the systematic treatise is itself a symptom, a way of pretending that a personal drive is an impersonal proof, and he says plainly that the will to a system is a lack of integrity. A word on the title, because it is the most misunderstood thing about the book. Beyond Good and Evil does not mean beyond good and bad, and it certainly does not mean anything goes. Nietzsche is proposing to get behind one particular moral scheme, the one that sorts the world into good and evil, in order to ask where it came from and what it is for. He thinks there are other schemes, that ours is historically recent, and that it has never been examined because we have been standing inside it. The book opens by putting philosophy itself in the dock, and the opening question is the one everything follows from. The will to truth, he says, has tempted us into many dangerous ventures. So let us ask a question nobody has asked: what in us really wants truth? Why not untruth instead? Why not uncertainty or ignorance? He is not being flippant. His claim is that the value of truth has been assumed rather than argued for, and that a philosophy which cannot account for why it wants truth has an unexamined moral commitment sitting at its foundation. From there, he makes the accusation the whole part rests on. Every great philosophy so far, he says, has been the personal confession of its author, a kind of involuntary and unconscious memoir. Philosophers present themselves as having arrived at cold conclusions through pure reasoning. In fact, they have taken a conviction they already held, usually something about how one ought to live, and constructed a system to justify it afterwards. The reasoning is advocacy, not discovery. He then takes the tools apart, one at a time. Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." Nietzsche points out that this smuggles in an enormous amount. When a thought occurs, what we are entitled to say is that thinking is happening. To say I think adds a thinker, an agent behind the act, and that agent is a grammatical habit rather than an observation. A thought comes when it wishes, he says, not when I wish. Free will gets the same treatment. He calls the idea of a self-caused agent, a cause of itself, the best self-contradiction ever conceived, a kind of logical rape. But he refuses the opposite too. Unfree will, the idea of being merely a machine driven by mechanical causes, is just as crude. Both are mythology. What actually exists, in his account, are strong wills and weak wills, and the argument about freedom is usually a disguised argument about responsibility and punishment. And then the positive claim, stated for the first time in argument rather than in poetry. If we could explain our entire instinctual life as the development of one basic form of will, which he calls will to power, then we would have earned the right to define all effective force as will to power. The world seen from inside, he says, would be will to power and nothing else. Part 2 is about the kind of person who could think the thoughts in Part 1, and it is more unsettling than it sounds. The free spirit is not the free thinker of Nietzsche's own century, whom he despised. The 19th century freethinker had simply swapped Christianity for progress, science, democracy, or humanity, and held the new faith with the old fervor. Nietzsche's free spirit is defined by the ability to hold a conviction at arm's length, including his own, and to be suspicious of anything he finds himself needing to believe. He describes the process as a great detachment. You break with what you revered, precisely because you revered it, and you go through a period of loneliness and sickness in which nothing is fixed. The test is not whether you can destroy your old attachments, but whether you can survive the emptiness afterwards without immediately manufacturing a replacement. Here he introduces a word he uses for himself and his kind, Vasuka, which carries three senses at once: attempters, experimenters, and tempters. Philosophy for such a person is not a body of results, but a series of attempts conducted at personal risk. He also says something about honesty that is easy to miss. He calls honesty the one virtue he and his kind cannot get rid of, and then adds that they must work on it, because it is their only remaining virtue, and they do not yet know what to do with it. That is not modesty. It is a suspicion that the will to truth might itself turn out to be a moral prejudice, and that seeing it through could be dangerous. Part 3 is on the religious character, and it is not simply hostile. Nietzsche treats religion as a psychological phenomenon and asks what it does to people, and to that question his answers are mixed. He grants that religion has produced discipline, endurance, and a capacity for reverence and self-command that he admires. He is contemptuous of the comfortable atheism of his contemporaries, who had discarded the belief while keeping every value that depended on it. But the core of the part is a claim about cruelty. He argues that religion has been an instrument of cruelty turned against the self. First, people sacrificed human beings to their God. Then they sacrificed their strongest instincts, their nature. And finally, in the last cruelty, they sacrificed God himself, worshipping the stone, stupidity, gravity, fate, or nothingness, because there was nothing left to sacrifice. This is the ladder he thinks religious history has descended. His specific charge against Christianity is not that it is false, but that it inverted the order of rank. It has taken the side of everything weak, low, and failed, made an ideal out of what is opposed to the preservation of strength, and turned the human being into something smaller. He calls the European of his day tamer, more mediocre and more comfortable than his ancestors, and he blames 2 millennia of moral breeding for it. He also grants Christianity a kind of dark credit. It made the human soul interesting. In making people ashamed of themselves, it produced depth, complexity, and self-observation of a sort no healthy animal would ever have developed. Nietzsche's relationship with the thing he attacks is never as simple as his readers make it. Part 4 abandons argument entirely for 123 aphorisms, and it is the most quoted section of anything Nietzsche wrote. Some are jokes, some are cruel, some are among the sharpest sentences in German prose. A few of the most famous, paraphrased closely: he who fights with monsters should take care that he does not become a monster in the process. And in the same section, the line everyone knows: gaze long enough into an abyss, and the abyss gazes back into you. There are no moral phenomena at all, only a moral interpretation of phenomena. This is the whole book in one sentence. Insanity in individuals is rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and eras, it is the rule. Whatever is done from love always occurs beyond good and evil. The thought of suicide is a great consolation and has got many a man through a bad night. Madness is rare in individuals, but in the mass it is the norm. A people, he says elsewhere, is nature's detour to arrive at 6 or 7 great men and then to get around them. The reason this section matters beyond its quotability is that the aphorism is not a decorative choice. Nietzsche uses the form because it forces the reader to supply the connective work. A well-made aphorism cannot be skimmed and cannot be summarized, which is his defense against being turned into a doctrine. It is also, as we will see, the reason he was so easy to turn into a doctrine anyway. Part 5 is where the book earns its reputation, and it is the direct ancestor of On the Genealogy of Morals a year later. His starting complaint is that no one has yet done the actual work. Moral philosophers have spent their time trying to justify morality, offering rational foundations for what they already believed. Nobody has treated morality as a natural object with a history, collected the material, compared the systems, and asked how the thing came about. What has been called the science of morals is, he says, a very refined form of moral advocacy. When he does the work himself, he arrives at his central distinction. Every morality is a system of commands directed against nature and against reason, and its value lies in what it disciplines. But moralities differ in whom they serve. The dominant morality of Europe he names herd morality. Its instinct is that whatever endangers the herd is evil, and whatever preserves it is good. It elevates pity, humility, patience, and modesty, and it fears the exceptional individual because the exception is a threat to the average. Crucially, he says, this morality speaks as though it were morality as such, the only possible one, when it is in fact one type among several and a relatively recent one. He also makes an observation about obedience that is more interesting than the polemic. What is remarkable about Europe, he says, is not the freedom of its people, but the extraordinary and unnoticed degree of obedience in them. Most people do not have a commanding will and are relieved not to. And the ones who do command, he adds, usually do so under cover of some higher authority, telling themselves they are only obeying God, the Constitution, reason, or the greater good. Part 6 turns on the professional intellectual, and it is a sharp piece of sociology. Nietzsche watches the scholar declare independence from philosophy, and sees it as the revenge of the specialist against the generalist. The scholar is honest, industrious, and useful. He is also, in Nietzsche's account, a mirror rather than a source. He reflects, records, and objects, but does not create values, which is what he thinks a philosopher is actually for. He draws the distinction that governs the rest of the book. There are philosophical laborers whose work is to take existing valuations and press them into formulas, and there are genuine philosophers who are commanders and legislators. Their knowing is creating. They determine the whither and the why of humanity. He is aware how immodest this sounds and says it anyway. Part 7, Our Virtues, examines the virtues of his own kind and is where he asks what a late, self-conscious, historically educated European actually values. He finds honesty, a taste for hardness, a suspicion of comfort, and a residual cruelty, which he says has merely been refined rather than removed. Almost everything we call higher culture, he argues, rests on the spiritualization of cruelty, including the pleasure of tragedy and the intellectual pleasure of forcing your own mind against its inclinations. This part also contains sections 231 to 239 on women, which are the worst pages in the book. They are dealt with directly later in this summary rather than passed over. Part 8 is about nations, and it is the part that most decisively refutes the way Nietzsche was later used. He goes through the European peoples with an ear for their music and their prose, and the treatment is that of a critic rather than a partisan. He is at his rudest about Germany. He mocks German profundity, German beer and newspapers, the German soul with its corridors and hiding places, and he says that what Germans call deep is often merely muddy. He had by this point broken with Wagner, and the section on Wagner's music is unmistakably a breakup letter. His positive proposal is European rather than national. He argues that Europe wants to become one, that the differences between its peoples are being leveled by trade and travel, and that the type of person the future needs is what he calls the good European, a supranational figure with no fatherland. And on the Jews, he is unambiguous, in a way that requires no charitable reading. He calls anti-Semitism a symptom of the small-minded and the envious. He describes the Jews as the strongest, toughest, and purest race in Europe. He attributes to them a set of virtues he admires, and he says explicitly that he has never met a German who was well disposed toward Jews and worth taking seriously. He suggests that Europe would be better served by absorbing Jewish strength than by expelling it, and recommends deporting the anti-Semitic agitators instead. Keep that section in mind for what happened to his reputation after his death. The final part is the most important and the most dangerous, and section 260 is the passage that made Nietzsche's later reputation. He proposes that there have been two basic types of morality, and that most actual moralities are mixtures of them. Master morality begins with the strong, and it begins with self-affirmation. The noble type determines values from his own sense of fullness. He calls himself good, and the word means noble, capable, whole. The opposite term is not evil but bad, meaning low, cowardly, petty, useful, timid. Notice the order. The positive comes first, and the negative is an afterthought, a description of what he is not. Slave morality begins with the weak, and it begins with a no. It looks outward at what threatens it, calls that evil, and only then constructs a picture of itself as the opposite, which becomes good. The order is reversed. The negative term comes first, and the self-image is derived from it. What gets valued in this scheme is whatever eases suffering. So pity, patience, humility, and kindness become virtues, and strength, pride, and hardness become wickedness. Two points that readers consistently miss. First, Nietzsche is not saying that the strong should be cruel to the weak and calling that good. He is making a historical and psychological claim about where two vocabularies came from, and observing that the word evil, with its particular flavor of moral condemnation, was invented by the second type and did not exist in the first. Second, he thinks slave morality won, and he thinks it won for a reason. It is more interesting, more inventive, and more spiritually productive than the frank, rather stupid confidence of the masters. His objection is not that it triumphed unfairly. It is that it now speaks as if it were the only morality there has ever been. The rest of Part 9 describes the noble soul and what he calls the pathos of distance, the sense of rank and difference out of which he claims the drive to enhance the human type has always grown. The book closes on Dionysus, whom he calls a philosopher, and then on a poem in which he admits how few people can join him where he is, pulling the argument together. That the will to truth has never been examined, and that asking what in us wants truth and why is the first genuinely philosophical question. That every great philosophy has been an involuntary memoir, a personal drive dressed as an impersonal proof, and that the reasoning is advocacy after the fact. That the thinking self, the free will, and the self-caused agent are grammatical habits rather than discoveries, and that our metaphysics has largely been the shape of our language. That life is will to power, and that the world understood from the inside would be that and nothing else. That the free spirit is not the free thinker who swapped one creed for another, but the person who can survive the emptiness after a conviction without immediately manufacturing a replacement. That there are no moral phenomena at all, only moral interpretations of phenomena. That the morality of modern Europe is one morality among several, the morality of the herd, which serves the average against the exception while speaking as if it were morality as such. That master morality says yes to itself first and calls the rest bad, while slave morality says no to what threatens it first and derives its self-image from that refusal. That what we call higher culture rests on the spiritualization of cruelty rather than its removal, and that the philosopher of the future will be a commander and legislator of values rather than a scholar or a laborer, which is the most immodest claim in the book and the one Nietzsche least defends. This has to be stated plainly rather than tidied away, because it is a real defect in a book that is otherwise about examining unexamined assumptions. Sections 231 to 239 are Nietzsche on women, and they are bad. He asserts that woman's fundamental nature is one thing across all history, that scholarship and independence damage her, that the movement for women's rights represents a decline, and that the relation between the sexes is properly one of ranked antagonism. He does it in the same confident register he uses everywhere else. Three things can be said honestly about this. The first is that he opens the passage by admitting these are his own truths, and elsewhere in the same book he insists that every philosophy is a personal confession. So by his own standard, this is a confession about Nietzsche. The second is that the usual defenses are weak. Reading it as irony does not survive contact with how consistently the same view appears across his work and his letters. Reading it as merely conventional for his century does not work either, since he presents himself as the man who examines exactly the assumptions his century holds without noticing, and here he simply does not. The third is that it damages his own argument. A book whose central method is to ask where evaluation came from, and whose central charge is that philosophers rationalize their prejudices, contains a stretch in which the author rationalizes a prejudice and does not notice. That is not a reason to discard the book. It is a reason to read the rest of it with the suspicion he taught you. Beyond the passages on women, here is the reasonable criticism. The method cuts both ways. If every philosophy is the involuntary memoir of its author, then so is this one, and Nietzsche knows it. He gestures at the problem and does not solve it. A thoroughgoing suspicion of all claims to truth has trouble accounting for its own status, and readers have argued about this for a century without agreement. The aphoristic form protects the arguments from testing, A claim made in a single brilliant sentence cannot be checked, and the brilliance does a great deal of work that evidence would otherwise have to do. Some of what looks like insight is simply a very good sentence. The historical claims are asserted rather than shown. The master and slave morality story is a powerful piece of psychology and a thin piece of history. He supplies almost no evidence in this book, and the following year's genealogy is in part an attempt to supply some. The politics are genuinely uncomfortable, and not only for the reasons people assume. His talk of rank, of order of rank, of a new nobility, and of what he calls the great politics is not the racial nationalism it was later made into, but it is unmistakably anti-democratic and anti-egalitarian, and no honest reader should sand that down. And the concept of will to power is doing more work than it can support. In this book, it is offered as a hypothesis, hedged and conditional. Elsewhere, it hardens into a metaphysics of everything. As a psychological observation about drives, it is fertile. As an account of physical reality, it is not defensible, and Nietzsche never published the book that would have tried. What survives is very large indeed. The suspicion that stated reasons conceal unstated motives, the historicizing of morality, the attack on the unified subject, and the demand that we examine our own values rather than merely obey them, have all become part of how educated people think, usually without knowing where the habit came from. A word on how to read this alongside the rest of Nietzsche, because the order matters. Thus Spoke Zarathustra came first and says the same things in poetry. It is the more famous book and the worse introduction, because you cannot check a chant. Beyond good and evil, this book is the argument. It is where the ideas are stated in a form you can disagree with. On the Genealogy of Morals came a year later and is the most systematic thing Nietzsche wrote. He described it as a supplement and clarification to this one, and if any single sentence here interested you, that is where the case actually gets made. If you are starting from nothing, most readers do better beginning with the genealogy, then coming here and leaving Zarathustra until the ideas are already familiar. The lasting provocation of this book is not master morality, and it is not the will to power. It is the opening question, which almost nobody asks, and which does not have an obvious answer. Why do we want the truth? What is it in us that wants it? What does that drive serve? And what would we find if we turned the same suspicion on our own commitment to honesty that we cheerfully turn on everyone else's commitments? Nietzsche does not answer it. He thinks the attempt to answer it honestly is what a philosopher of the future would be for. That was the summary of Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche. This narration is an original summary and commentary, and it paraphrases rather than reproduces any translation. If it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.